Yeah, he was saying that the city council had gotten together and stated that the campground where the those three people that belong to the city councils had said that anybody can go in there to their designated boundaries and build a cabin if they wanted to. But he said that the game warden, they had written, these three person had wrote a letter to the game warden stating that I think they own these boundary and stuff. And the game warden would help them. And when he went back to Savonga and showed him the letter that the game warden had written to the teacher, and the teacher had gathered the city councils together and stated that you can't do this, because in the letter here, it stated these campgrounds belongs to these people here, and you can't just go in there and build the cabin. This is what he was explaining. And I asked him if he had that letter. He said that he no longer have that letter anymore.
Thank you, sir.
Our next speaker is Margaret. Is Margaret Sigana? And I'd like to state, Mr. Bridger, that she has written a series of articles just on her own thoughts, and she's brought them with her, but she fears that if she turns them over, that they may be reprinted without her permission. And that's what's holding her back from, giving us copies. But I would like to know if you want to speak to that.
Well, if we can have them, ma'am, we will not reprint them without your permission.
I just want to make that clear to you. This is Margaret Sigana.
Thank you. In my articles, I try and point out what the native values are, how the natives lived their own lifestyle. And what impressions I got from conferences I attended, and through our program, to the villages that we went to for workshops. And that was to Uniklit, Savunga, Shismaref. And we had several workshops here. And our theme would generally be the native values, the native spirit. What the natives thought of the spirit was they had a great being that was the overseer, the controller, the provider. And within their communities, he was the controller, provider, and the overseer of all. Natives believed that everything had a being of its own, like clouds, wind, sky, water, sea, the earth, even rocks. And in the spring, they say, the earth is coming alive again. And it was through, they knew it was through the great being that everything lives, even animals that they caught. But animals or sea mammals were never abused. Everything was used. And where I came from King Island, I know the women, when their husbands got a seal and he brought it home and he put a few drops of water in the mouth to as an offering to the spirit, to the being of the seal. And then his wife starts cutting it up, and she took off a little bit of meat and blubber, gave it to one of her sons, and told him to throw it outside. And in that way, telling the being, the spirit of the seal, we are thankful for your giving yourself to us. And you will see that we do not abuse your being, because through you we have life. And these things were misunderstood, misinterpreted, because natives were very religious people, and that was their religion. And so when the even missionaries, Catholic missionaries, whatever, when they came, they told the natives, you're not speaking to the true God. Here's our white God. Here's the true God. But that confused them, because their great being was within them. They related to one another through that being, and it was in the family, in the community. It was all over. So the white God was distant, some demanding. They were afraid of him, not like their own great being, who was kind and gentle, providing. And they didn't know how to relate to the white God, because the white man, when he came, he was telling natives, don't do, while the natives among themselves would instruct their children, their grandchildren, this is the way we do it. It is up to you to follow the way we do things, or else go your way. You have the right, you have the privilege of learning through the hard way. And there were no harsh words between mother and children, father and children. But then there was a custom that was, when a child needed to be scolded or whatever, they really didn't scold. This came, the reproach came through a third person. The parents would tell. Maybe the father would ask his brother, the mother, her sister or brother, or the grandparents to speak to the child. So the what I know, when I was among the King Islanders in their community, there was no violence. Nobody locked their doors. Everything was open to anybody. Children didn't run around destroying things. And the first thing that children were taught, to respect their elders. But first, it came, as he was growing, he was taught to respect all his family, his mother, his brothers and sisters, as they went in age, the grandparents, and then it would spread through the community. And I've been asked what causes alcoholism in natives. At first, I didn't realize, I couldn't make out either. I was confused too. But then we went to Savunga, and we had our workshop through our program over there. This is the program is called the Eskimo Heritage, and they're field workers in these villages that we go to for our workshops. And while we were there in Savunga, the elders were gathered together. And at that time, there was a lady there that interpreted what the elders were saying. And one of the elders was saying, children nowadays do not have any discipline. While in the old way, children had to work for what they wanted. And he said, nowadays, children say, I want this, I want this, give me this, give me this. But then he said, if right now the children are disciplined and told, if you want it, you work for it. And this, he said, for centuries, generations and generations, that what children were taught. They were taught responsibility through working for what they wanted. And after that, I started realizing, when I thought back, when I was asked what causes alcoholism in natives, I realized the loss of native values is the cause of alcoholism in natives. And somehow, we had the elders conference a couple years ago, and the elders, one of their resolutions was to integrate native values, native ways into the schools. And I think through, if somehow we could get that going, we would find that natives do have dignity and pride.
Thank you very much. I look forward to reading the articles that you've been kind enough to let us see.
Frida Larson. I'm daughter-in-law of one of those people that mentioned reindeer herders. My father-in-law was one of the herders that come up from Norway, Buskap, Norway. And a lot of people think he's a Laplander because he come up with Laplanders, and he was from Buskap, Norway. How I knew that he was that he's from Buskap, Norway, was because I have his marriage license in my possessions now. My late husband and I, my sister-in-law gave us that marriage license. That's how I know where he's from. So I would like to say, when they put out land claims,
I didn't know that we have to put our land claim certain time, because I didn't have no sophisticated education. So a lot of it, I don't know what's going on since my husband passed away. But I understand that a lot of people in the land claims, I have fish camp out in 67 Mile, and I have another one down at Fort Davis with Mrs. Oman, and I are side-by-side fishermen, fishing women, women. So we don't even know where we are at right now. And up at Coosa Tree and River, another fish camp of mine since 1954, I understand I might lose that claim because of Kwerek people. Land claim good portion of that area up there in Coosa Tree and River because it's connected with Mary's Igloo, Alaska. And so from that on, I've been trying to find out where I can find, really find out where my rights are out there in that area. I'm still seeking to find out what my, if I supposed to have, when I bought that place, I supposed to have cabin and with 5 acres. 5 acres would be, mean lots to me if I could only settle that place so I can call it my own. Right now I can't even call it my own, and that's my subsistence place. I'm still fighting for my subsistence area along with Lila Oman. And one day I hope we really find out where we are, so we can say, this place of mine out in the Coosa Tree is my little cabin with 5 acres. I can't even say that right now because I don't know. I'm not notified if it's legal. I call lots of times to the land claim office to see where I'm at, but they say I shouldn't worry about it because I've been there since 1954. So give me a little, put my morale up a little bit on that. So when you get kind of this age, you would like to enjoy the enjoyment of the land. I'm outdoor woman. This is my real good doing every summer. I don't care for others dancing or anything. I much rather be out there in the wilderness and do some subsistence, gather food for myself since I'm widowed. Before I'm widowed, I even do that. So I would like to, this is my peace. I wish they would let us know where we're at now, so we can call those things our own. That's all I can say.
Thank you, ma'am.
Since Frida mentioned my name, I'm going to put in my 2 cents worth here. Frida and I had real, real hard time with BLM. Not too long ago, BLM was trying to take piece of our subsistence area down Fort Davis. To begin with, I couldn't file for this land because it was native allotment. At that time, I was married to a white man and passed as a white man, I mean white woman. Luckily, one of my boys that was home just before he was drafted was old enough to file for this land. So he filed and we helped him, and we keep it going right along. And when BLM came in and another native guy was trying to take a piece of my land and piece of Frida's land, and we fought hard. We really fought dirty in order to hold that. While we were fighting for this little section between Frida Larson's and my land against this man, this BLM guy was also taking another chunk off of my area on the other side. I didn't know that. And when I was building my cabin there, here someone said I was violating. I said, this is inside my boundary. And I fought hard right there again. That is not settled yet. But I know where my boundary is. I know my rights. And we were the very first ones that did our boundaries down there. And to tell you the truth, people that used to live quietly and harmoniously side by side, look what is happening when we have boundaries. And that there was a big slaughterhouse there with tin roof and tin sides. It was a reindeer slaughterhouse. It was abandoned and it was given to us. Here, before I knew it, this other family was even trying to take that part of that slaughterhouse away from me. Finally, I told them, my area is not on the other side of the road. My area is on this side of the road. This boundary was set here before some of these BLM people came. Those are Frida's boundaries and my boundaries were staked in 1966. I remember that year very well because I was running for Mrs. Alaska that year. And I'm always proud I got the congeniality that year. And I traveled down towards Bethel. And when I came back from Bethel, I was still dressed up. And I remember trotting around all over on that land in high heels and trying not to step over this and that. And I know just where my boundaries are. And this summer we had real hard time. Frida was even putting her nets right under my fish rack. And you know what that does to a net. The oil eats up the net. And I said, what happened here? Somebody was already laying his nets over on her area. Right there, I just made up my mind, I've got to settle this because Frida is too intimidated by this man. So I picked up her Sigvik, her board where she cut her fish. I packed it right over where it used to be. And I went right to that family and told them, this is Frida's area where she lays her nets. And she is crowding me over that way.
I think I have a question.
Okay.
I don't need that. I can speak loud.
Okay.
Who are you people? Okay. I didn't even know this meeting existed.
Well, I explained that earlier, sir. My name is Tom Berger, and we are reviewing the Land Claims Act.
The meeting first met in the convention center,
yeah.
And the next one coming up at 2 o'clock today.
Yeah.
And what is this meeting about?
Well, the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and the World Council of Indigenous People asked me to come to Alaska and hold meetings like this in villages and towns to see what Alaska Natives felt about the land claims settlement, about ANCSA, how it's worked out, the good and the bad. And then I'm to write a report that the ICC and the World Council of Indigenous People can take to the United Nations. And the report will be sent to the people here. And if they decide that it is useful in planning their future, then they will be able to use it for that purpose, to approach Congress, to make changes, and so on. And we had a meeting yesterday at the Mini Convention Center, and there were quite a lot of people came, and about 30 people spoke yesterday afternoon and yesterday evening, and we wanted to give some of the elders a chance to speak, so we came over here today. But we're going back to the mini convention center at 2 o'clock this afternoon for the public.
Now,
do you mind speaking into the microphone, because then it can be recorded. We want a permanent record of what's said.
Like Nick Wongatel here, who spoke about St. Lawrence Island, that is where I came from some 20 years ago, so therefore I don't own a mining claim. Now, I thought I knew something about land claim, but I don't. Now, I came across somebody writing recently, if I remember right, the wording of it, when the United States bought Alaska from Russia. I wasn't there. You weren't there. I don't know how in the world there were no such things like land claims. I would like to know, because you can't answer all my questions right now. We have to go back and forth into Interpol conference in Washington, D.C. How in the world the land claims in that direction were made out? We are about 100 years old and little more only. Whether the mining companies only the mining companies were given so much territory and disregard all other natives. Now, these meetings have been going on and on about land claim. What they are striving for and about, that I would like to learn in the future. Is it because that something is not quite good in that area? It's not done right. Trying to correct some of the errors, because many of these natives are somewhere out in the I'm not going to hold that. These people are getting hungry. So I don't really know too much about land claim. I do own a little property in Nome, right under my house, and that was all, a little camping place. Once I asked some of my friends, acquaintance here, how much of this land under my house do I own? Of course, he didn't know. Do I own the surface of the land, or as far as I can go under my house? He asked me why. I want to go mining right under my house, while drilling. I was just trying to get some opinions from different people. He said, to tell the truth, I don't know. But I've seen these people dig under their house and build a basement. And they are never been told, you dig so much and no more. Maybe you can go oil drilling under your heart if you want to go. So I have to learn many, many things about land claim before I sign a thing. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
I'm Margaret Sigana, and what I heard about boundaries a while ago just brought back to mind how the natives in the old time, before the white man came, villages had their hunting grounds, and from village to village, each village knew the boundaries between their village and the next village, and they didn't intrude into the next village's hunting grounds. They kept to their own, and there was peace between the villages. And what, I don't know, what I see, what I feel, is the white man trying to make white people of the natives, but that's confusing to natives. And what white man laws pretend to them, they don't realize and they don't understand. It's confusing. Well, in the old days, there was peace between villages, between peoples.
Thank you.
My name is Myrtle Johnson, Myrtle Fagerstrom Johnson, and my mother and dad are both alive and living here in Nome, John and Minnie Fagerstrom. They're both 82 years old, and before coming down here this morning, I asked my dad, what do you think of the land claims, Daddy? He said, it's the bunk. And it was bunk from the very beginning. And my mother added, it's just one big mistake. I would like to say something. A number of us felt, I turned on my radio this morning because I thought the elders were going to be speaking, and I thought so much wisdom would be coming from our elders that surely it would be on the radio station this morning, but it wasn't. I'm going to say my piece down at the Mini Convention Center at 2 o'clock because I'd like for the younger people, as well as the older people, to hear me. But I wanted to ask one question. I'm going to be asking it down there. And we were wondering, how much money or how big a budget are you working on? And where does the money come from? Is it U.S. dollars or Canadian dollars? I'm just a very money-conscious person, and that was one of my first questions I was going to ask.
Well, we have a budget that comes to, and this has already been made public, approximately $1.5 million, U.S. Mm-hmm. dollars. The Inuit Circumpolar Conference is raising the money, and they have obtained money from the North Slope Borough, from foundations, and from churches in Alaska and the lower 48. And we have had some donations from corporations and, of course, in-kind services. So mm-hmm. that, for instance, we usually don't stay in hotels. We stay in somebody's home or else, mm-hmm. as here, the Village Corporation has let us use the apartment they own and mm-hmm. so on and so forth.
Now, is this money that you're receiving from foundations and from corporations, is this in addition to the United States $1.5 million?
No. This is to make that...
This is to pay it back?
No. The...
Oh, this is in
No. Let me go back to the beginning. That's what we think we will need to complete the work,
mm-hmm.
to spend a year traveling and holding meetings like this, and to complete our work in the new year, and to write a report, and to publish it, and to send copies to people mm-hmm. who testify, as we intend to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we haven't raised $1.5 million. We're doing that as we go along, or the Inuit Circumpolar Conference is doing it as we go along.
Mm-hmm.
So we may not, we're doing the best we can with what we have as we go along.
Mm-hmm.
And we make a quarterly report to the Inuit Circumpolar Conference relating to all our expenditures, and all the contributions and where the money's mm-hmm. gone and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm quite happy to to tell you what you want to know about.
Yeah,
that.
Well, some of us that have been listening to the radio and just sitting and talking things over, we're just came up with that question. And I'd like to welcome you to Nome. And I thought I was going to be seeing the Alaska Review Commission. Is it what, how many people does this make up, or how many people are on the Alaska Review Commission?
Just one.
Just you?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have read about you in the newspapers, and I've liked what I read. And welcome to Nome.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Could you raise your hand? Okay.
I'm Tommy Johnson. I'm Myrtle's husband. As you see these elders in the community here, we have problems, let's say, with each Native corporation. I've sat on the board of the regional corporation as the director of finances, and we have growing pains, which I would say where the Bureau of Indian Affairs have set up Native allotments, we do not have that yet. Now, if you look at everybody in this room, and going all the way back to Mary here, I think that she'll only transfer her stock from to her children or children's children or to her grandkids, but I don't think she'll ever receive anything. And my idea on it is that the paper is fine, but we like to hold, let's say, ground, which each village corporation should go ahead and go through the process of giving, let's say, each stockholder in their village along the rivers or along the bay a piece of ground to each stockholder, so they would not 100 by 100, but maybe a 5-acre tract or a 10-acre tract, which they need for their subsistence living, or let's say so they could hold it in their hand and say, I've got a piece of ground, let's say at least from the ANSCA Act, which we have never done yet. But these people, the only thing they're ever going to get out of it is a piece of paper that they can transfer to their children. And I think that is wrong, because the minute that you go ahead and create a camp, and I've gone to the village corporation here, and let's say it won't hurt me, for the simple reason I've worked in the white man's way of living all my life. And I wanted to go ahead and build a home outside the city of Nome. And let's say, but they only want to give me 100 by 100 square foot lot, and that's not big enough. I said, what if I want to go ahead and put a garage adjacent to it? What if I want to go ahead and put a cache alongside of it? What if I want to go ahead and put other things on my piece of property? But still, again, we have to come into the city of Nome, where it's 40, let's say 50 by 140 lot, and that runs up to $30,000 just to have a piece of ground in town. And I think the regional corporation and the village corporation should try to go ahead and get additional ground to those people that live that never had a chance to go ahead and go under the Native Allotment Act. And that's all I have to say. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Thank you.
Tom, you have something to say?
Huh?
You have something to say?
No?
Okay.
Yeah.
John?
No.
Okay. John?
My name is John Jamilk, and I come from Ilam, and I'm the president of the Native Corporation that was created under ANSCA. And you know what I'd like to say is, I think Ilam, you know, has been one of the more fortunate villages under the Land Claims Act, mainly because the lands were transferred from the from being a native reservation. We have approximately 300,000 acres of land, you know, which is
about Elam or your own
company? Elam. And this reservation was created out of the use of the land that the people have had down there. And it, when the Land Claims Act came about, the village had an election either to go along with the with ANSCA or just take the land and not participate in the monetary benefits. And in that regard, you know, the election was almost unanimous that we just retained the land, mainly because we felt that the land was our provider, and it's always been our provider. And you know, since then, I think you know, since it happened, since the ANSCA was passed, we haven't had very much business, but you know, that's where we wanted, and that's where we had it in the past. We just lived in a subsistence lifestyle. Even that is changing, mainly because the stock was issued. You know, when the act was passed, the stock was issued, and sometimes we even have had to hire an attorney, you know, just to keep track of it. And you know, the attorneys, they cost money, so you know, we're having to go into the cash economy, and it's a slow process, but I think Elam is developing as it, you know, as its needs come about, and that's the reason I, you know, think Elam is it doesn't have to share with any other village in the lands that are developed. And since then, it's, you know, there's hardly been any development, and that's really the way we want it down there. The whole village is everyone, you know, there's a little bit of work, but most everybody lives off the land. You know, when the animals are in season, we go out and get them. So it's I think in that regard, Elam is one of the lucky villages as a result of the Land Claims Act.
How many people live in Elam, approximately?
Approximately 250. And when excuse me, when we registered everybody, there was 243 stockholders. Since then, the numbers have gone down a little bit, you know, because of the mortality rate, and you know, that's another problem I think about. When in the past, we were from under the IRA Act, and people became members of the village, you know, when they were born, or if they moved into the village, you know, and they were a quarter native, they became a member of that village, so the, you know, they were recognized. But now, as the population grows, you know, new babies are born, they've got to, you know, be borrowed some shares in order to become a member of that of Elam. And you know, I think in the future, that's going to create some problems for us.
That's an important point, I think, sir, because if somebody in Elam has 10 children and leaves his shares to his children, each child will have 10 shares. Somebody else may have only one child and leave that child all of his shares. So in the second generation, you get some people with only 10 shares, other people with 100 shares. Mm-hmm. By the third generation, it becomes even more imbalanced. And I suppose it's only a matter of time before the people holding larger numbers of shares say, well, these people who just have very few shares shouldn't be allowed to use the land. I mean, that's one of the things that human nature seems to make people do. But I just wondered how you felt about that.
I think it's going to create, it's already creating some problems, mainly because, you know, excuse me, our population has grown. Although there are 243 shareholders, not all of them are living in Ilam, and you know, our population has grown. At the time the act was passed, I think we only had about 180 or something like that. I don't exactly know the number, but you know, we've had some people move back to Ilam, and we've had some you know, some families that grow. And like my, you know, my family, for instance, both my wife and I are shareholders, and we have three children, and our three children don't have any shares yet, but you know, they're still living in Ilam, and they were born since 1971. And I could see, you know, many problems that come out of, you know, out of this. We've had some of our stockholders question that, and we don't have any answers yet. You know, there's got to be, you know, I think a real careful study done in order to, you know, somehow take care of that problem. And like right now, I don't have any, you know, have any answers to that.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're looking into, and we just want to know what the concerns are.
Viola, you want to say anything? Anybody else?
Yeah, if we have time, I'd like to ask a question. And this question comes from listening to the radio yesterday, and I thought maybe some of the elders would appreciate it. And that is, when 1991 comes around, is this the end of our subsistence way of living? I mean, that's, you know, the feeling I got yesterday, and somebody else did also. When 1991 rolls around, that's going to be the end of our being able to live